Hi, Kathy, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Randy. Thank you for having me on your show.
I know this has been a very busy year for you, and I just want to thank you again for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today. At what point in your life did you know that you wanted to become a musician?
As soon as I was somewhat aware. I think I was probably about 3 or so. My father was a saxophone player, and my mother was a singer. And I remember at a very early age listening to Ella Fitzgerald records with my father and singing along with the licks and also going on rehearsal dates with him and enjoying how the musicians flirted with me. That might have been a big impetus, I think. So it was very, very young. And I first started gigging when I was probably about 12 with my dad.
Well, seeing as your parents were both musical, I guess this next question will be rather difficult for you, Kathy. Do you remember the very first concert that you attended?
I'm not sure what the first concert I ever attended was exactly because of my family's musical endeavors. I do remember going with my mom and my two sisters when I was quite young to the Boston Commons to see Judy Garland and being terrifically impressed with her. And actually, I was terrifically impressed with her for most of my young life, and still am when I watch videos or listen to her recordings. She was an incredible artist, an incredible phraser. And actually, she and Rosemary Clooney were some of my biggest influences when I was younger. And then Ella Fitzgerald took over.
You've had a love affair with Japan for many years, haven't you?
I've been going to Japan every year since 1985. And it's definitely influenced my life.
What is it about the people that is so special?
The people I've met there who are engrossed in jazz are quite special, very similar to everybody in the world who is engrossed in jazz, and the artists over there especially I'm quite fond of. To tell you the truth, I think that the admiration from the Japanese is very similar to the admiration from Americans and Europeans. Every person who is in love with the form of jazz music is pretty much on the same wavelength.
Kathy, can you describe for us what the typical jazz club looks like in Japan and what kind of clubs that you were performing in during the past few years?
I must say I've had a great time over the years in Japan, going to these tiny jazz clubs, especially, I'm quite fond of. They're about the size of a small kitchen. And so sometimes, like, there's just enough space to walk down in between the tables and the bar, down to the piano, which is a very small little area stage, and the audience is quite attentive. And I've had some wonderful, wonderful musical experiences there, and it's a very social group also. You know, they want to hang out, and after the gig, you'll hang out on the gig and eat and drink and just socialize. It's really quite a nice scenario. And I've had some really fabulous concerts there also, large concerts, medium-sized concerts, but I have to say that the small clubs are one of my favorites.
Kathy, do you remember your first gig as a professional?
I'm going to have to think about that. Hold on. No. I actually don't remember my very first gig. I remember one gig that I went on with my father and my older sister, who was about 4 years older. And I remember singing Girl from Ipanema while my sister was forced to dance with one of the audience members, by my father, of course. And I remember enjoying it a lot. just having a great time. And I was, I'm sure that was before college, but I was gigging before college also. So I really don't remember the very first one. I remember...
Maybe there were gigs during your teenage years that you might remember that our listeners might be interested in.
I remember there was one gig that I did when I was about 18, and it was a show gig, and it was in Pittsburgh at a place called the Harmer House, where that was an interesting gig. I was there probably for a month with a three-girl act dancing and singing, and that was the first and last gig I did of that nature, because I realized while I was doing it that that was not the genre that I wanted to do. I am woman, tick, 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 you are a man, you know, that kind of thing. So, and while I was there, actually, Maynard Ferguson's band came through, and that made a big impression on me, and I actually met a few people who I had relationships with later in life in Los Angeles. So that was fun. That was an interesting gig. That was possibly the first road gig that I did, I believe.
You know, Kathy, one of the most important aspects of being a jazz musician is what they can learn that will help them out musically. Now, what did you learn from your various gigs outside of North America?
I would have to say that one of the most influential things that I've done and learned from, actually people I've learned from, was one of my partners, Philip Strange, who's a pianist, an extraordinary pianist, who's living in Florida right now. I met him in Japan. The first time I went to Japan, I was singing at the Playboy Club, two Playboy Clubs, one in Osaka and one in Tokyo, for 6 weeks each. I didn't go back for a few years, but when I went back next, I was singing with a pianist, not the bass player, but a pianist named Will Boulware. Not Wilbur Ware, but Will Boulware, who lives in New York now. And he and I had a duo for a month in Fukuoka, and it was there that I met a man who was to be my future benefactor there, Mr. Takanori Sugauchi, who lives in Kobe and owns a music school there. The music school name is Koyo Conservatory, and he's a good businessman and a small-time manager, and he met me on this gig, and he asked me if I wanted to come back and be booked. So when I did come back through him, he introduced me to Phil Strange, who was living in Kobe, married to a Japanese woman who is a wonderful musician herself, piano player, and he was working for Mr. Sugauchi. And this started a very long-term traveling relationship with between Phil and I, and we made several CDs together, one of which I believe you have, or maybe you have both. One as a duo and one with Phil and Peter Erskine and Mark Johnson, which is one of my favorite records that I've made. And so Phil, traveling with Phil was very educational for me. I remember one thing he said, which I still talk about today with my students, is I asked him what he thinks about when he's playing. And he said, I'm thinking about what can I do that's going to be fun? Oh, if I do this, that'll be really fun. And that is how he got the best out of players. I had just watched him time after time getting really the best out of the players that he worked with. And that taught me a lot. That was a fabulous thing. Also,
I guess there are so many lessons out there over the course of time and musical experiences that one could learn, eh?
There's so many lessons to be learned. I mean, I definitely take my musical relationships as philosophical and spiritual growth relationships. Another comment that I was on the road, but again with an American pianist from Los Angeles named Dave Mackay. He actually told me about starting solos before the downbeat of the chord. so that there's a line, a fluidity to the line. And that was something that really made an impression on me that I never forgot. Another more professional learning tool that happened to me was when I was in Yugoslavia. Of course, I went as the war was starting, of course. And I was in Belgrade, and I went to, I was working at a five-star Hilton. My plane was late, my clothes were lost. So the singer before, who was about twice the size of me, lent me something to wear, and I showed up on the gig, and the musicians didn't speak English very much, and they looked at me and were quite surprised because they thought I was going to be black. Apparently the agent sold them on a black singer whose name was Kathy Siegel Garcia, which was me, but obviously I wasn't black. So they had a little bit of an attitude. So that was not really a problem for me because I'm quite strong in my mind when it comes to relating to people. So I got up on the stage, and basically what I did was I called off cheek to cheek at a very fast tempo. One, two, one, two, three, four. And I didn't tell them before that it was going to be fast, so they were... they were surprised. They were a bit stumbling, but they were also great musicians, so they jumped in. But after that first song, I guess I had won their approval. So that was a musical professional lesson that I learned.
Wasn't there a moment when you were performing in Japan where there was this sort of simpatico going on between you and the audience, and there was a common language that was established right off the bat?
I was in Japan the first time I was in Japan, and I was at the Playboy Club, and the audience was entirely Japanese, and they didn't speak English, and so I felt very awkward because I felt like, well, whatever I say, they're not going to understand me, so I can't be funny, I can't be, you know, I can't be anything. I can only be the token American singer. And then something happened. I don't remember exactly what made me think this, but I realized that it didn't matter. What mattered was the communication of the art form and my communication, no matter if we spoke the same language or not. At that point, I just spoke whatever I wanted to speak, and I sang exactly the way I wanted to sing, and that night turned out to be a fabulous night. The audience was totally blown away. I remember I had a whole bunch of businessmen sitting right up in the front, and they loved it. They had a fabulous time because we were communicating, not with words, but we were communicating. One more thing about playing with different musicians all over the world is that you finally understand that you don't... There is adjusting to players, and then there's not adjusting to players. It's like a relationship in life. You know, if you get together with somebody in life, you don't want to throw yourself out the window, but you do want to adjust yourself to this new person, you know, and make, let's say, a third universe together. You know, there's two of you who each have their own separate universe that they live in, and then there's a third universe where you share together. It's kind of like that. So there was one player who was kind of a straight, conservative type of player, but totally swinging. And I was trying to match his style, which was impossible because that was not the kind of singer I was. So at some point I just gave up on that and just started doing my kind of loose, modern self. And then it became magical. It was really an interesting lesson for me. So the best that you can be as an artist is yourself, the best yourself, not the best anybody else, you know.
Were there any key events in your childhood that led a profound impression on you, Kathy?
My father was a saxophone player, my mother a singer, so I had a bunch of records. My father was also a musical director of a radio station, so we had a lot of records at the house. And so I grew up listening to his choices, of course. And at some point, I believe it was before college, just before college possibly, somewhere I heard the Modern Jazz Quartet. And my sister took me downtown to Paul's Mall, and we sat in the front row, and we listened to the Modern Jazz Quartet. And I was totally blown away. That was the first album that I bought of jazz. Before that, I had been buying, you know, 45s of pop and Motown and, you know, the regular high school kind of stuff. And so that was the first jazz album that I bought. And that made a big impression on me. That groove, that smoothest swing in the world. I just totally was knocked out by that, and it was one of my loves forevermore.
You know, when I listen to your recordings, I always get a sense that you're having fun in the studio, not only with the music, but with the band and the surroundings and just the spirit of the moment. Care to comment on that, Kathy?
I definitely am having fun. I think I'm smiling a lot when I sing, when I perform. And because what's there not to have fun about? You know, it's just, it's such a groove, especially playing with wonderful players, you know. And I always stress that with students to create art and have a good time between you and the musicians first and foremost, and then the audience picks that up. I don't stress the artist looking out at the audience and staring at people in the face. I know a lot of singers and teachers do that, and maybe it bugs them that I don't do that so much. I do it in certain situations, but it's not of prime importance to me. Prime importance is getting the artistic happening, and then I believe the audience can pick that up, and that's the most favorite. And a lot of people have told me the idea that it looks like I'm having fun, and they enjoy that, you know. They enjoy that it looks easy and it looks enjoyable, and, you know, it makes them feel like that too. So it's a good thing.
I have to ask you this. Do you use any vocal coaches when you're singing or trying to keep your voice in shape?
I have no vocal coaches now. Well, what I do, or what I have done, technique-wise, I'm a very definite technique person. I studied with a woman named Helen McComas. She was my favorite teacher that I had in the last 20 years. I studied with her for quite a while, and actually two other singers, Sonny Wilkinson and Kevin Latow, the three of us found her. Actually, Kevin found her, and we all three went to her because we had all three been going to another teacher that we weren't satisfied with. And Helen was here in Los Angeles, and she was a big supporter of physiological and also philosophical studies of the voice, a technique coming down from an Italian master named Herbert Cesare. And it's physiological. It's how the voice is built and how it works, vocal cord-wise especially. Anyway, Helen was a great influence on my life. She made me a teacher, as she made Sonny and Kevin as well. And just gave me the tools to have a really good instrument that I can depend on no matter what my artistic self feels like doing. The other things that I grow and develop from are more scatting practice, such as I get together with Michelle Weir, who's a very well-known, internationally well-known educator and vocal arranger. She's a singer, bit of a pianist, and she and I get together a lot and scat together and invite different guests to our scat sessions. Those are really great for me. They make me stretch, and we have a ball. And then I have my weekly jam session too, so I've had that for about 3 years. So in that, I always feel like I'm stretching out too and using what my new ears have to say. A lot of listening. I do a lot of listening. That's another thing that Phil Strange helped me with, the pianist that I've traveled with quite a bit. He, when we're on the road in the car in Japan, he's always making me listen to stuff. And that's very educational and very fun. I'm a big listener. I love that. So most of the other growth in my singing has to do with stretching harmonically. And I guess you could say technically, you know, runs and that kind of stuff.
Are there any musicians out there that you would love to play with that you haven't had a chance to perform with yet?
Chick Corea is one. Although I know Chick and I've recorded at his studio and I've sung a song of his, Bud Powell, who nobody else has actually recorded that song. And but I've never had the opportunity to sing with him, and I would really like to do that. I would like to play again with Peter Erskine and Mark Johnson. I'd probably like to sing with John Scofield, Bill Frisell, John Abercrombie. These are some of my favorite guitar players on the planet. And I think Joey Calderazzo is fabulous, and I would be interested in singing with him a little bit. Paul Motion, I would love to play with him. And Bob Moses, I would love to play with him.
What inspires you?
Sometimes a relationship will inspire me. I've written, in the past especially, I've written quite a few songs about men interests in my life. And of all kinds and natures. And sometimes just a feeling, sometimes a little piano part that I'll have, or sometimes I'll write a melody first. Various things, various reasons. Sometimes, well, right now I'm writing for a movie, and so the movie subject matter is leading me. Different moments in the movie need different things, and that's inspiring me to compose a certain subject.
For me, the 1940s was an important decade on so many levels, and I think so many great vocalists came out of that period. And I was just curious as to whether you ever thought of what it might be like to go back in time and have a chance to sing during that period with the big bands and the great musicians that flourished during that great decade.
Oh, yes. I do think of what it would be like to be around at that time. It was, in a way, simpler and then in some ways harder, I'm sure. But the music was much more direct, and if you were good, you were just grabbed up and accepted and, you know, thrust into it. The artists were so intense then, too. It was, you know, there was no airy-fairy artist around. Although, maybe there were, and we just haven't heard about them. You basically heard a lot more about the fabulous artists.
When you were growing up, was your voice the first instrument of choice for you?
Yes. I also played flute and I played guitar, but singer, I knew I was going to be a singer probably at about 3 years old.
In regards to singing and composing, who are your main influences, Kathy?
Singing, probably Ella first, and Rosemary Clooney and Judy Garland. Those singers affected me the most as I was growing up. Then, as I grew older, I got into more funk music. Aretha Franklin and Chaka Khan were some of my heavyweights. And then Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, that whole thing, Joni Mitchell. And then Flora Purim, maybe. And as I grew older, I actually got into Sarah Vaughan and Carmen McRae more, Betty Carter. I didn't really get into Irene Krall until I was much older and somebody said I sounded like her. But I never really listened a lot to her, but she and I have, I guess, similar tone and similar stylizing, phrasing. In recent years, I've been affected deeply by various singers, Jay Clayton, Nancy King, Meredith D'Ambrosio, who is a really interesting singer, very, very unusual to me, and precise while still free. Very interesting. And composing, probably just people I listen to. My influences My favorite, some of my favorite listening music is modern. John Scofield, that kind of modern, and players like Bill Evans and that body of music that he plays. So I'd have to say standards, some of the classic American songbook composers. And more in recent years, my last project, which was kind of what I call alternative jazz, called Secret Life, I think I was influenced quite a bit by Sting.
Kathy, I'd like to feature a track off of your CD entitled Point of View. What would you like to hear?
Well, let's see, regarding Point of View. When You Wish Upon a Star is one of my favorite pieces on that. But also A Child Listening is quite beautiful as well. A Child Listening was written by my ex-husband, Gus Garcia, who's an incredible artist, guitarist, composer, and also painter. And A Child Listening was, he wrote in honor of his father, who died when he was quite young. His father was a man named Gonzalo Curiel, who was one of the most famous composers Mexico had, so famous that they dedicated a day every year to him. And his mother was a fabulous bolero singer named Adelina Garcia. So he wrote this song, and I just always felt like this song was connected to some spiritual connection that was quite heavy. Quite a beautiful song. However, if you pick When You Wish Upon a Star, which a lot of people really enjoy listening to, that was arranged by a pianist named Bill Lohr, who now lives in Dallas. And it was quite a beautiful arrangement. I'm very fond of that arrangement. And that song, of course, was from my childhood, so it was a sentimental song for me.
There's a song off of Song of the Heart, which I really enjoy. It's a heart-wrenching number for me to listen to. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts were when you you sing this song, and what you're feeling.
That is probably one of the most favorite songs on the album and favorite songs of my performing. People request that a lot, and musicians seem to really enjoy it as well. I'm probably going to perform it at Birdland in New York in January when we all go to the IAJE, International Association of Jazz Educators, conference. And a group that I've created called the Jazz Vocal Coalition, a group of jazz singers, about 150 members strong, about nine of us are going to perform at Birdland on Wednesday the 20th. And I'll probably do that song because that is a very well-accepted song. That song I started writing about a friend of mine who I had known through college and after college. And then I met a little girl. I started writing it about my friend Diane, but while I was writing it, I did a gig, and a little girl came up to me and sat down on my lap. You know how little girls are, very open and warm and trusting. And she just sat on my lap and started talking to me, and she breathed her little girl breath in my face, and I totally fell in love with her. And I finished the song about her because it was the right moment. This version of it is especially beautiful because there is a version of it on Point of View, which is nice, but Song of the Heart has a very beautiful version of it. Very slow, very spacious, very beautiful. The musicians played great.
What music did you listen to growing up?
As I said before, my dad was a sax player, my mom was a singer, so a lot of big band music, Stan Kenton. I was listening to my father's music until I was probably a teenager and I could pick my own music that was not that style. But Stan Kenton, Ella Fitzgerald, Rosemary Clooney, Ella Fitzgerald, The Four Freshmen, anything that my dad had in there. Art Blakey, he was into Art Blakey. He was not a super jazz head, he was a swing jazz head, you know. And so that's mostly what the music was that I listened to. And at the point that I became a teenager and started listening to my own, first, I think what was happening was the whole Woodstock group of people, which I almost went towards that musically, and for some reason I picked jazz. But that Crosby, Stills, and Nash thing, oh, that was definitely an item for me. And Then the funk era came in, the perfect funk era, with Motown just blaring. So I don't even know all the names of the people that I loved, and Chaka Khan were two of my very, very, very favorites. And there was, as I got into college, there was Tower of Power was really smoking. Blood, Sweat, and Tears was really smoking. Chick Corea was really smoking. So those groups really influenced me. Then I started really listening to Miles Davis and Pat Metheny. So the ECM label was really coming in quite strong at that moment. And that might have been when they first started. There was Oregon and there was Weather Report. I mean, you know, Oregon and Weather Report, right there. Fabulous, fabulous. So that really sent me on my way.
Do you ever listen to older recordings to maybe learn a new style or get new ideas while you're composing or vocalizing?
I don't do that. However, what I do is I do listen to older recordings. I buy older recordings, and I appreciate them. Like, I think a few years ago, I finally got the Johnny Hartman, John Coltrane record, which was absolutely stunning. Oh, boy, he sang great. And recently I got a Charlie Parker recording. And so I do listen a lot. And I love listening. And there's so much to listen to now, including friends, what they're doing, and just new and favorite recordings of my favorite artist as well. I think that John Scofield has impressed me in a way that I can incorporate his songs, the way his songs are built, and his approach to performing as well. Tickles me to death. Paul Motion, Bob Moses, these people I really admire a lot. They are almost orchestral. They use space, but they also use their fabulous musicianship. The Mingus Big Band, by the way, is another one like that. Fabulous musicianship, almost sloppy in the most controlled way. And I love that, because I consider that a big portion of music is about the flow. If you're efforting and if you're stopping the flow at all, you're going to lose out. If you're connected to the flow, rhythmic, harmonic, melodic, perspective, all of that, you know, scatting, anything. It's all connected to a flow, no matter if it's a ballad or a swing or Latin, whatever it is.
One of the intriguing aspects about jazz is that when you're creating, your inspiration comes from everywhere, and I think that that's what makes it so challenging. And I'm sure that you have some ideas, Kathy, about what it's like to be musically challenged in relation to this wonderful art form.
I'm always looking for situations that intrigue me, but that have a flow. I have learned that over the years. You can force yourself into certain musical situations that are not really good for you. You know, such as singing a many-worded song just to be impressive or just to be able to do it. That never works for me. It's if I'm feeling like on top of it and I want to sing four with all the verses, great. But if I'm not, I don't want to force myself. I want to sing what I'm feeling good about, what is happening around me at the time. In my weekly jam session, it's a very interesting fact to note that however I feel during the day, I come in, and that's how everybody else is feeling. And all the audience members, all the band members, and we play the music, and the music takes on whatever that is, whatever spiritual thing is going on. It's a very interesting thing, and that's another reason why I think the jam session is very valuable, because it kind of keys it out, you know, it releases the tension of whatever has been created there. I think the most musically challenging question that I always have for myself is, what am I going to record next? What grouping am I going to use that really does sound good? How am I going to arrange the songs that aren't, that the arrangements aren't trite, but they're very interesting? One of the most interesting recordings I've heard recently is by Madeline Eastman, her new CD, Speed of Life. It's fabulous. Great, fabulous arrangements.
If you ever thought of putting a dream band together, Kathy, who would it consist of?
I always change in my viewpoint of what I really love at the moment. And this is actually a reason why I know so many musicians in Los Angeles and I work with so many different musicians, because I find that the same song with 10 different musicians is going to come out 10 different ways, and I'm in love with all of them. So maybe that's because I'm a Gemini, but I don't know really, but I've always been like that. And in my early years of performing in Los Angeles, I had this gig for 2 years every Tuesday night. Whoever would show up in the band, the establishment would pay $5 and a meal to. So I started getting players who, first of all, would play for that, and I started learning about my music and the musicians and just the subject that I was talking about, that everybody creates a different thing. And I just couldn't stick with one particular group. I love certain people. I love certain things that they play, certain ways that they play. And that's fabulous in itself, but there's so many absolutely wonderful players. Also, being a singer, even though I'm not the typical kind of straight down the road singer, I'm a little more free and modern in most of my performance, but being a singer, you do have to take that into consideration. First of all, you do want somebody who can accompany, and that's a real art. But also, I want somebody who's not going to accompany in a very square way. I want somebody who's going to treat me as a musician. So those two aspects are very important. I've mentioned some of my favorite musicians who are famous, and there's lots of absolutely incredible musicians in Los Angeles. Pianist named Tamir Hendelman, who works with the Clayton Hamilton Orchestra quite a bit. Dave McKay, very fabulous piano player. Karen Hammack, wonderful piano player. These are some of my favorite pianists. And guitar players, I'm in love with guitar, so I've worked with Ted Green quite a bit over the years, and he's an awesome, awesome player. Larry Kuntz, guitar. Jamie Finley, guitar. John Stoll from Oregon, oh, fabulous. And of course, there's really so many, and it's hard to name everybody and all my favorites, and for various reasons, personality has a lot to do with it, and the quality of playing, of course. I definitely am up and ready for a guitar trio recording. It's one of my favorite groupings to play with, guitar, bass, and drums. And I have some groups here that I've worked with that are really just so musical that I really want to record that, one of the next recordings.
Let's say you were stranded on a desert island and you only had, let's say, 10 recordings to bring with you. Which ones would they be?
Oh, that is really hard. I guess there would be some Miles Davis records. Kind of Blue, Birth of the Cool. There was one, 7 Steps to Heaven. I think I played that every single day when I was in college, first thing when I woke up. I might want a Sting record, because I really do love Sting's voice and what he creates. I really, really love that. Maybe an Abby Lincoln record, and possibly Carmen McRae Sings Monk. I'm in love with that record. At least one John Scofield record, probably more of the groove stuff, or Grace Under Pressure, actually, is one of my all-time favorite records of his. The writing on it I really, really love. Probably want a Thelonious Monk record with a band, something that's kind of swinging. And I probably would like a Paul Motion record. I don't seem to get tired of that. There's parts of Mike Maneri, Mingus Big Band, Weather Report, but I don't know if I would take the whole record over and over and over. I might, though. You never know. Let's see. Anybody else? I probably would take a Stephanie Haynes record. She's one of my truly favorite singers on the planet that I really never get tired of listening to. And Bill Evans. That would be something of Bill Evans would be really nice. I also really love Mark Copeland and Kenny Werner. So, and Peter Erskine records. I really like Peter Erskine records. So I might be tempted one of those. I know that's way too many to answer your question, but, you know, some things are hard to answer.
The internet has played a big part in many musicians' lives and altered the way that they deal with their fans and the business as a whole. Kathy, do you care to comment on this?
You know, that is kind of Pandora's box, and it's a big area to confront. One thing that's happened over the last 2 years, which has been highly intriguing to me, is that every month I will get a number, I'd say between 8 and 20 requests for autographed pictures from all over the world, which I find highly interesting, and the letters that accompany these requests are really amazing. A lot of them will say how wonderful I am and what I'm contributing is fabulous, which intrigues me that somebody in Germany actually knows this or thinks that they know it or says it. My website has brought me a lot of interesting connections. People find me. Some woman who was having serious voice problems found me and downloaded my internet book and actually turned around her vocal problem and emailed me a huge thanks on that. I wrote a vocal technique book. And let's see what else. That's actually coming in towards me, communication coming into me. As far as me looking on the web for things to get involved in and connections to connect to, I mean, it's endless. It's absolutely endless. And communication is so much more easy. You still have to make contacts. You still have to do the work, but it's the marketing field is multiplied about a million times, so I think it's a extremely valuable tool.
Talk a little about your Jazz Vocal Coalition. I'm curious as to what it is and what's involved with this new organization of yours.
How it got started was, a few years ago I was at the IAJE, and I had convinced about 12 or 13 singers to get a booth together. An exhibition booth, and which we did. It worked pretty well, and we had fun and shared the highlights of the booth. Promoted ourselves, and you know, had a place to send people, and had a place where people walked by and said, "Oh, who are you?" It worked so well that Ellen Johnson is a singer also, decided, you know, we really should take this a little further, because we felt like it was a needed and wanted thing to get a group of jazz vocalists together to help each other and expand certain areas that we felt needed to be expanded in the marketplace and education facilities for jazz, solo jazz vocal artists. So we also hooked in another woman who was there as well, April Lang, who's a bit more of a studio singer than a live performer. And the three of us live in L.A., so we started getting together and talking about this and forming up ideas. And that's how it started. That was about 2 years ago, maybe. And this year we really got down to business to solidify the organization and the basis of the organization. And we probably have about 175 members right now, international, mostly national, but some international. And our focus at this moment in time is going to the IAJE convention in New York, where we have a huge presence, actually. We have two booths. We had to expand our space from last year, and because last year was the first year that the real Jazz Vocal Coalition existed at the IJE. One booth was just way too small. We had a very popular booth. So this year we're having two booths. One side will be geared towards the organization and schmoozing, and then the other side will feature two singers every hour, promo and CD and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Then Ellen, who became the president, is leading a panel discussion on the future of solo jazz singing. And this panel has Mark Murphy, John Hendricks, Andy Bay, Sheila Jordan, Jay Clayton, Kitty Margolis. And so this should be a fabulous piece. I am one of the two people leading the vocal jam session for the IAJE, which always has hundreds of singers in it. And we're associated with Singer Magazine now. We're sponsored by Bose and JetBlue. And we're also performing outside of the conference Wednesday night, nine of us, which includes me, we're performing at Birdland. And I think Mark Murphy or John Hendricks is going to also be performing with us. And we'll have a trio. And then the next two nights we'll be performing, like probably 20 more of us will be performing at Chez Suzette, which is also nearby in Manhattan. So, and the coalition is, the coalition's goals and purposes are to educate the public, the general public, which includes educational facilities and marketing people and labels and audience, educate them more towards vocal jazz, solo vocal jazz specifically, and growing in adeptness, creating more situations, more hiring situations, and more work situations for all of us. And we feel that as a group, we can get a lot more accomplished than in certain situations than as solo people out there, you know, struggling. Another point that we really want, especially me, is to really highlight in respect, give more respect to older, fine-tuned jazz singers. That's a pet peeve of mine personally. I mean, I love the mermaids, as I call them. The young, beautiful, wonderful singers, you know, who are 21 and 25 and have a long future ahead of them. I love that. I think that's great on all accounts. But I do not want to see older singers put aside because they're older. In our field, older jazz singers are great. I mean, that's what we work a lifetime towards, to get fine-tuned, to get eloquent, to get artistic. So that's a big pet peeve for me, too. So after the IAJE, we're going to be working on a compilation CD. We're going to be working on a songbook of original material put out by the members. We have an online store. And by the way, it's the website is www.jzvoc.org, Jazz Vocal Coalition. We have growing opportunities, and it can only go up from here. We have a few different chapters as well, one in Los Angeles and one in New York.
What do you have planned for upcoming recordings or events or anything of that nature?
I have several recording projects I'd like to work on. One is with a John Scofield-like trio, Jeff Richman on guitar and Joel Taylor on drums and Dean Taba on bass. There's another conglomeration of guitar trio that I would like to record with too, and that's with Jamie Finley on guitar, Dean Taba on bass, and Kendall Kay on drums. I also would like to create something with Jamie and also Karen Hammack, who's the pianist that I mentioned, kind of spiritual in nature. Not per se exactly spiritual, but all songs relating to a spiritual nature. It could be as obvious as Amazing Grace, or it could be not that obvious in the choice of material. And I would really like to have a straight ahead record. In January, I'm planning on recording with guitarist John Stoll, just a duo thing. And last year, I actually tried a live recording. Now, they called me crazy for this, but it was with Tamir Handelman on piano and three guitars. And Barry Zweig, Jamie Finley, and Larry Kuntz were the guitarists. And it was quite fun. It was a live recording. The recording quality didn't really come out well. So in that way, it was a failure. But in the musical way, it was quite fun, and I thought of bringing that into the studio. And I have another group of songs waiting that, again, I call alternative jazz. And by that, I kind of qualify this music as Sting meets Cassandra Wilson. It's jazzy, but it's simple. But and I'm using a jazz trio. On the last record that I made, Secret Life, I used a jazz trio, Karen Hammack on piano, Chris Seimer on bass, and Kendall Kay on drums, and with a few other players here and there, and a lot of background vocals. All of the material was original songs. And it was definitely a different kind of project for me. And it wasn't really jazz, and it wasn't really pop. And that's why I said Sting meets Cassandra Wilson. I'm shopping it around. It was with a label originally, but it was one of those horror story labels. And didn't quite work out the way I had intended it, although it's a great demo, because it actually is a finished recording. So I have another body of songs in that ilk, and I do want to do that. In fact, I'd like to have a label behind this first project, because I think the music is extremely timely. It is alternative, and I think alternative is a genre of music, no matter if it's from rock or pop or jazz. So I think it's a really good music that a lot of people would like.
Any funny road stories that you'd like to share with us?
When I was recording with Peter Erskine, just a little thing that happened that cracked me up was that I was telling him about Dearly Beloved, which is on Song of the Heart, and I said, this is going to be Peter Erskine style, and he said, oh, you mean Latin? And to me, that was funny, because that's exactly what I meant, and he knew. Now, Peter Erskine told me a funny story. I interviewed him once for a magazine. He told me a funny story, but I don't know if that applies in this particular case, because this is about me. But here's a funny story about Peter Erskine. When he was younger, and he started with Weather Report, and he thought he was really cool. They had done Black Market, and they were listening to it. And he and Zawinul were standing by the speakers listening to it. And you know, there's different styles of playing for drummers. Some drummers mimic what's going on in the other instruments. You know, like if somebody goes, boo ba boo ba doo 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 doo, you know, then the drummer's going, doo 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 doo. You know, they'll mimic it somehow. And he did that, and he looked over at Zawinul, and he said, that's cool, huh? And Zawinul said, or actually, I don't think he actually said that. He looked over at Zawinul, proud of himself. Zawinul looked at him and he said, too bad you had to do that. And that changed his life forever, which is a great story to me. I think that's a really wonderful, wonderful story. You know, I've been thinking about this. It's really difficult for me to come up with great stories about my past experiences, of which there have been thousands. I had one, to me, which was a very funny story, which was I was the token American singer in a Russian band, and we got a New Year's Eve gig, and the New Year's Eve gig was for 500 Jewish Latinos. I have no idea how they got that gig. The only music that they had in common, the band had in common with the 500 people, was Jewish music. And when we would play a Latin tune, the people would come up and say, "We need to hear some Latin music." So that was the only gig I desperately wanted to be home in bed on. That is my funny story.
How long does it take for you to make a recording, Kathy? Are you the type of person that spends a lot of time in the studio laboring over detail? Or are you the kind of musician that goes in there, knows what you want, and makes a recording?
That is a luxury that I haven't had, which is to say hours and hours recording. What I've generally done for recording has been, at the very most, about 3 days of recording, and hopefully more than one day of mixing. I don't like to fix. I would rather have musical, artistic feeling going on, although some things really do work better if they're punched. Definitely need a vocal producer in the studio because I tend to get too much aware of myself, too much into my own head in the studio. And it's nice to have a person outside of yourself going, "Yeah, that was great, fine." Or, "Yeah, I think you could do it again and be a little lighter, don't push." You know, just stuff that you don't have to think about, because wearing too many different hats while you're in the studio recording is a little bit difficult.
Do you usually record live in the studio?
I have recorded live in the studio, but I do prefer if a setup which enables me to go back and change if I want. So it's always intriguing that the live performance can sound so amazingly fabulous, but if you record it and it sounds so amazingly fabulous live, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to sound so amazingly fabulous from the studio. Although it could. I recorded a live gig with Tamir Hendelman on piano and Barry Zweig on piano. I mean, Tamir Hendelman on piano and Barry Zweig on guitar and myself. It's so live you can hear the waitresses, you know, doing their thing. And the gig has so much life in it. It's fabulous. And we all sound pretty damn good. And we're making music and we're joyous, and I really enjoyed that part of it. I hope that the CD with myself and John Stowell in January is going to be like that.
I know a lot of musicians like to practice a lot, and I was just wondering, Kathy, if you spend a lot of time practicing.
Well, I practice every day a little bit as far as scales. I work my lower register, that kind of thing, and my higher register, because it would probably blast your ears out. I try and do that a little bit every day, because when my voice is warmed up every day, I could be called last minute on something, whether it's 2 hours or 6 hours, and actually have a voice and have all my facilities that I enjoy. I like to have a very even voice throughout my range, and I like to be agile, and I don't want to hear myself straining or breaking anywhere. I also I take advantage when I'm teaching my students improvisation. I take advantage of that myself to develop my own improvisation as well. When I'm showing them something, I'm showing myself as well. I think I mentioned before that I get together weekly, almost weekly, with Michelle Weir, and she and I scat and sometimes invite other guests to do the same thing with us. And there will be certain things I'll practice. I will practice particular songs, sometimes certain little ideas that I'll practice, like learning jazz heads or going through books with various scales, and that's that.
What are you listening to these days?
Well, these days I seem to be getting a lot of CDs from friends, and I'm enjoying them greatly. Two guitarists who live in L.A., Reiner Sivoli and Ron Berman, both outstanding modern type of guitar players, and they've had a duo that they've worked together for about 8 years. I'm just totally enjoying that. Stu Elster, a pianist in town, he gave me his CD. I'm thoroughly enjoying that. A singer, Pamela Jackson, who I've tried to support over the years, a person who hasn't really been out in the limelight very much, but who really deserves notoriety. The Speed of Life CD. Let's see, who else have I been listening to lately? Betty Carter and Carmen McRae. I think it's live in San Francisco. A little bit of Miles Davis. Always go back to him. I have a real nice CD with Bill Charlap on it that I really enjoy a lot. It's what is the title of that one? It is called The Gift. It's very nice. Bill Charlap, Stephen Kyo, Louis Stewart, Mark Hodgson.
Kathy, I'm going to throw some names your way, and I just want you to come up with the first thing that comes to mind. Okay, let's start off with Helen Humes.
I'm sorry, you know, I'm not a big listener to Helen Humes, so I don't really have a solid opinion about her.
And what about Rosemary Clooney?
Rosemary Clooney, I love. Rosemary Clooney, to me, is one of the most adept phrasers, honest phrasers, that ever recorded. I love her voice, the tone of her voice, and her phrasing is fabulous.
And someone who you've worked with before, our own Diana Krall.
Diana Krall, she's really interesting. I know Diana from before. She was living in L.A. for a while, and we had mutual friends, and she actually played piano for me on gigs. She wasn't really singing. And her singing is really nice. I really like that more recent live album that she did. Anthony Wilson is on it too, who is another incredible guitarist as far as I'm concerned. Absolutely incredible. And anyway, Diana, in the beginning when she started singing, I didn't like the recordings. I thought the producing, you know, whoever was producing her vocally was missing. I thought she sounded strained on certain things, and I wasn't really digging the sex vibe the whole time. It was just like, okay, this is a really sexy thing, and here's another sexy thing, and another sexy thing. But I think that that has transformed, and I really enjoy what she's doing. I really hear a lot of growth, and just, you know, she's really settling into being a singer. I think it's great.
And, of course, one of the great big band leaders of all time, Count Basie.
Count Basie. I don't have a long history that I've observed about him, except that listening to him for years and years, especially my dad had Count Basie stuff. I mean, rhythm and chords, and it's just fun and fabulous, and it fills you up, and it's not overfilling. You know, Count Basie is fabulous.
And one of the great popular vocalists of all time, the great Frank Sinatra.
Frank Sinatra, you know, another king of phrasing. Tone, singing, finesse. I didn't care for him all that much in the later years of recording, but to me he was one of the kings of jazz phrasing. And I do say jazz phrasing. Some people might not call him a jazz singer, but I do.
Someone that you mentioned earlier, Charlie Parker.
Charlie Parker. Fluid. A master. Creator of melodies. I just always think of him as, you know, sometimes I get these pictures of people in almost a visual way, like, it's hard to explain, but if I'm trying to tell a student about a visual on where they're singing, like if they're singing, it's kind of midway behind your eyes, you know? If they're singing down here, it's, you know, down around their mouth area. And I know that's a strange way of describing Charlie Parker, or this thing I have to say about Charlie Parker, but Charlie Parker to me was above the eyes. There's some kind of a level that he's playing from, artistic place, and it always seemed endless. It never seemed like he had a stop. He ever stopped, or he ever had a stop on the flow.
Now, you were mentioning guitarists and your love of guitarists. How about Wes Montgomery?
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful player. Swinging, melodic. You know, I told you before that I didn't really know a lot of names of records. I only knew the songs and I recognized what was being played. So I don't have a history of which record I like of Wes Montgomery's, but he just gave off a real beautiful vibe musically. Real, again, on a flow and real, real there, never falling off. He gave a lot to our genre.
What about Ron Carter?
One of the best jazz bass players in the history of jazz. Beautiful sound, beautiful tone, perfect time. Was involved with some of the very best cream of the crop jazz artists. Made a huge contribution.
Talk a little about how you actually got around to setting up your vocal clinics.
I would have to say about 5 years ago, somehow I got the idea that I should have these vocal clinics at my house. And so I started having a Saturday or Sunday vocal clinic from about 11:30 to 3. That was the standard hours. And 11:30 people would come over and have some coffee and whatever I had out. Now I have bagels. And we would get going, and I would be the clinician. Then I started actually inviting other professionals to be the clinician. And people coming into town do the clinics now. As a matter of fact, this weekend we have Kathy Cousins from Detroit coming in to do a business clinic for jazz vocalists. Most of the workshops are about singing, and most are about jazz singing, either phrasing, performance, sometimes technique, improvisation. But every now and then I'll have something else. I'll have a blues singer come into a clinic. I'll have Brazilian, Anna Gazzola. I've had lawyers come. I've had songwriters, Mark Winkler, one person who comes to mind. These have been going on probably about 5 years, and they're very reasonably priced. Now they're usually about $30 or $40, and it's a very safe environment. You get wonderful information, and if you continue going to them, you really get a great overview, because you see that we're all on the same path and we're all talking about something that is extremely meaningful to us, a perspective I'm talking about, a real specific perspective, something we've overcome perhaps or come to understand in our own life through music, or the music, the perspective that we apply to the music is also a perspective that we have in our personal everyday lives. So it's really quite fascinating, and I also like the idea of not being so competitive that, you know, couldn't possibly have somebody else in here teaching. I like that, which is another reason why I created the Jazz Vocal Coalition. I don't like cutthroat competitiveness, and I don't think it's helpful. I think it's more helpful to create things that everybody benefits from, and that way everybody can create things that everybody benefits from, and boy, before you know it, we'd have a very happy planet. So these workshops are great. I've had, just to name a few people, Meredith D'Ambrosio, Julie Kelly, Madeline Eastman, myself, of course, Barbara Morrison, Kitty Margolis, Diane Hubka, Judy Nemac, Leah Klein, Leila Thigpen. Both of them are from Europe. The workshops have really created a lot of good things. Of course, education being one, and the spirit of sharing amongst the professionals, and also amongst the people who come here. You know, it keeps acknowledging that that is possible and plausible. And it also is good advertising for me, and it's a continuation of the jazz vocal form for the most part. And it's a very safe environment. That's another really nice thing. It's a really good learning growth situation.
Before I let you go, Kathy, can you talk a little bit about your new album entitled Secret Life?
I'm not sure which song on it I would say was my favorite song. It's hard to say because they all have a very special meaning for me. I'm just looking at the cover. Probably either My Friend or the song might be one of my favorites. However, Miko Oiwake is also a favorite of mine. Anyway, the song, was the song that started this whole project.
How did that all come about?
Several years ago, I had a number of middle-aged women coming to me for lessons, and they all were very wonderful, very spiritual, and a lot of depth to them. And I started writing this song called The Song. And actually that started the whole project into motion. And one thing led into another. Very obviously, I was going out with a bass player at that time. He became the producer of this record, and he sang on it. There's a lot of background vocals, including him. And when I first was practicing the music, I got together with the trio that I had mentioned, and they said, let's not do your jazz stuff, let's do your pop stuff. And a few months after that, I asked them how much they would need to make a demo, and literally the next day, I got a call from somebody asking me if I would mind working on a pop record, you know, creating a pop record for this company. And I was like, Anyway, as it turned out, I'm very thankful I got to finish it. I do own the CD itself, and I can do with it what I want. So, anyway, it was a really good experience, and it came out with some really interesting recording of history for me.
Kathy, I just want to thank you for taking the time out. I know you're a very busy person, and you shared many ideas with us today, and I wish you well in the future.
Thanks, Randy. Really appreciate you.